You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a former Environmental Protection Agency official tells us why he's opposing President Trump's pick for head of that agency.
First, a new study on cervical cancer treatment and minority groups finds that a woman's race plays a big role in her treatment outcome. A study published last week in the Journal Obstetrics and Gynecology found nearly half of minority women receive cervical cancer treatment that doesn't meet national standards.
These results come on the heels of another recent study that found African American women are dying from the disease at a rate comparable to that of women in many poor developing nations.
Dr. Laurel Rice joins us now. She's chair of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. She's also the co-author of this latest study on minority women receiving poor treatment for cervical cancer. Dr. Rice, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Your newly published study on cervical cancer looked at more than 16,000 patients. Can you fill us in on what you discovered?
Yes. It is well known through a variety of sources that cervical cancer in this country, while the rate is quite low, is disproportionately high in underrepresented minorities. Publication that came out this month highlights that fact, both in terms of incidence and mortality, and directly attributes it to the lack of healthcare providers to follow national cancer established guidelines. So there are a large number of patients in the study, as you mentioned, and the conclusion shows, again, that there's racial and ethnic disparities in the delivery of guideline-based care. And it's not just at low-volume hospitals, it's at high-volume hospitals as well, if not more so.
Yeah, go into that a little bit. You found this greatest disparity in care was found at high-volume hospitals. What's happening there?
Well, I think the assumption has been in the past that at smaller hospitals, smaller healthcare facilities, the rate of the lack of following guideline-based care would be higher. And that assumption is based on a variety of thoughts and concepts. But I think what we can see here is that it's not relevant. Patients who are underrepresented minorities at every level in terms of hospital capacity still continue to suffer from this disparity in outcomes as it relates to cervical cancer.
And your findings go hand in hand with this other new study that found African American women are dying from cervical cancer at a rate comparable to women in third world countries. Are both of these studies telling us something about the continuum of care for women who happen to be Black or Hispanic?
Yes, and Kate, I have to tell you, this is corroborative evidence. There is a plethora of data that supports health disparities as it relates to race and ethnicity for cervical cancer in this country. It's just that with both of these new studies, it looks at it from a slightly different angle. And the paper that you just talked about that came out in Cancer highlighted the fact that when one, meaning the healthcare system, corrects for women who have already undergone hysterectomy, the disparity as it relates to race becomes even greater. Because obviously, if a woman has had a hysterectomy, for the most part, developing cervical cancer is highly improbable. So I just need to say, I don't think this is novel, either study. I think both studies highlight the fact that this cancer disproportionately affects underrepresented minorities. And it raises, you know, a very important question in this country, which is access to health care. Because cervical cancer is preventable. There is an excellent screening platform to screen and diagnose pre-cancer and then treat it. And underrepresented minorities are not enjoying the same access to health care.
Well, let's bring this back to Wisconsin. In the day-to-day clinical setting, have you seen patients or heard anecdotes that these racial disparities in cervical cancer outcomes are happening right here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think in my practice, it's very difficult to discuss anecdotal data, but there is a very strong data set put out by the Wisconsin Cancer Data Bulletin that really shows that Hispanic women in Wisconsin are 2 times more likely than non-Hispanic women to be diagnosed with cervical cancer, and that the incidence rate of cervical cancer is 80% higher among African-American women than white women. So Wisconsin is just as it is in the rest of the country, disproportionate number of underrepresented minorities are suffering from cervical cancer.
We're talking with Dr. Laurel Rice. She's chair of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. She's co-author of a new study in the journal Obstetrics and Gynecology that found nearly half of minority women receive cervical cancer treatment that doesn't meet national standards. With the repeal or perhaps retooling of the Affordable Care Act that's likely to be on the horizon here, what do you see coming up that could impact women and cervical cancer prevention and treatment?
Well, I think that the landscape looks very difficult. It's hard to predict what's going to happen as it stands right now, but this particular cancer, in that there is successful screening and treatment of early pre-cancer, would be disproportionately affected by a decrease in access to care. And I don't know that to be the case, depending on what happens at the national government level, but I do believe that the Accountable Care Act provides for women in a meaningful way, women of lower socioeconomic class, and all the other factors that contribute to health disparities.
And cervical cancer screenings, as you said, are supposed to be very good and widely available at the clinic setting. What are the barriers you see for minority groups to get access to this preventative care?
This is a multi-pronged problem. If you look at socioeconomic class, resources, racial discrimination, education, health disparities in this country are based on a broad platform, and there's just no doubt it exists. The dissecting the reasons for that and correcting them is obviously much more difficult. I think, you know, it's not only screening for cervical cancer, but then it's the next step of treating pre-invasive disease, because we know that if we treat pre-invasive disease, we can obviate the development of cervical cancer.
So how can physicians and health systems fix these racial disparities? Because, as you said, cervical cancer is largely preventable.
Committing to programmatic expansion of screening services for women, all women, women of lower socioeconomic class, et cetera, is the first step. And that is a broad platform. It would require investment and commitment to women's health and recognizing where many women of lower socioeconomic class do receive their health care, keeping those clinics highly functional. For example, Planned Parenthood does a lot of screening for cervical cancer, and I think that's a fact that's overlooked by many. And I think that there's not one answer to that question, but it takes commitment and resources and acknowledgement that this is a preventable cancer.
So, can this cervical cancer research tell us something more broadly about cancer in minority populations?
Well, I think that across the spectrum, I can't think of, maybe it's a lack of funded knowledge, I can't think of a cancer that disproportionately affects underrepresented minorities. So again, this is not a novel concept in and of itself. Health disparities in this country has been studied by the Institute of Medicine, the CDC. A lot of attention has been focused on it. So while it's not novel, I think it does put the spotlight on this. And I think that the opportunity to make a difference here, if we invest and really pour some energy into preventing cervical cancer would pay off.
Dr. Rice, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate the opportunity.
That was Dr. Laurel Rice, Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. She's co-author of a new study that found nearly half of minority women receive an inferior standard of treatment for cervical cancer. The findings were published last week in the journal Obstetrics and Gynecology. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about an effort at the state capitol tomorrow to bring attention to water issues around Wisconsin.
First, almost 450 former Environmental Protection Agency employees signed a letter released yesterday urging the Senate to reject President Trump's pick for head of the EPA. Scott Pruitt, the Oklahoma Attorney General, has opposed past environmental regulations and has sued the EPA 14 times.
Supporters of Pruitt's nomination have argued that he will streamline the federal government's regulatory overreach. A coalition of conservative advocacy groups that back Pruitt as a choice said he has a record of being a, quote, stalwart defender against federal intrusion into state and individual rights.
But Pruitt's opponents have still shown concern over his record of challenging the agency's legal authority, especially when it came to regulating things like pollution, smog, and carbon emissions from power plants.
Eric Schaefer joins us now. He's executive director of the Environmental Integrity Project and former director of civil enforcement at the EPA. He's also one of the signatories on the letter that urged the Senate not to confirm Pruitt as the EPA director. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Ferret, for having me.
Well, I haven't heard of this happening in recent years. I don't think former EPA employees, seems like they stay out of national debates a lot. Why was this something that so many decided to speak out on?
Well, passions are running pretty high about Mr. Pruitt. And in fact, we've have nearly 600 signatures on the letter. They keep rolling in, and we're just going to keep adding them. And these are coming from EPA veterans, scientists, engineers, lawyers, other professionals who've worked for Republicans, they've worked for Democrats, they've faithfully, you know, carried out the law, and they see something very different and very dangerous in Mr. Pruitt.
And what do you see that is different and, as you say, dangerous?
Well, to speak bluntly, based on Pruitt's record and on his public statements, he's been a mouthpiece for the oil and gas industry, the Farm Bureau, and the other industries that EPA is supposed to regulate under the Clean Air and Clean Water Act. He's attacked the agency and its mission relentlessly and very loudly since he got elected as Attorney General. He's filed lawsuits to stop efforts to limit mercury emissions, reduce haze in national parks, limit greenhouse gas pollution, protect water quality. I mean, you name it, almost anything EPA's done in the last few years, he's against it. So how in the world did we end up with this guy as the nominee to head an agency that's supposed to protect the environment?
The president has made the case, and his supporters too, that the EPA has maybe done too much in recent years, views this appointment, I think, as a corrective to try to limit the scope and interference with business has been the main argument. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, to be clear, Mr. Trump, President Trump, when he campaigned, promised to reduce EPA to little tidbits and basically to vaporize the agency. And when I say little tidbits, that's a direct quote. So this isn't a, you know, what they're trying to sell as sort of a mid-course correction or just adjust some policies. Every administration does that. And you expect policies to shift when you see a new Republican or a new Democratic administration. But what the agency has to do is work within the law. It's got to really respect and carefully consider environmental science. And it's got to act in the public interest. The agency is for everyone. The environment's for everyone. It's not about grinding an axe for the Farm Bureau or, you know, an oil and gas driller, which is all we can see that Mr. Pruitt has done. That's been his career.
What do you worry about when it comes to the environment if Mr. Pruitt is confirmed and the changes he's been pulling for take place?
Well, that people will be exposed to more pollution and will pay the consequences, will pay the bill in terms of you know, more danger to public health, more pollution of rivers and streams, and more greenhouse gases. That's the worry. And, you know, I'm also concerned that he's made rolling back regulation his top priority, and that's, again, a direct quote. He said that very clearly, getting EPA off the backs of the oil and gas industry. That's just not – that may work in Oklahoma. That's really not what you do as head of EPA. You can cut back on some things. You can try to lighten the regulatory load, but you can't reduce the agency to nothing, and you can't just, as he did in Oklahoma, take drafts that are written by the energy industry and just sign them without any changes. That doesn't work at EPA. You can't get away with that here.
You mentioned greenhouse gases. Climate change is one of the big issues for the EPA. Pruitt, in his testimony, has openly disagreed with President Trump's assertion that climate change is a hoax. He said he believes it's real. And here's a clip of his Senate testimony being questioned here by Senator Bernie Sanders about what he thinks the causes of climate change are.
Do you believe that climate change is caused by the emission, by carbon emissions, by human activity?
Senator, as I indicated, you weren't in here during my opening statement, but as I indicated in my opening statement, the climate is changing, and the human activity contributes to that in some manner.
In some manner?
Yes, sir.
97% of the scientists who wrote articles in peer-reviewed journals believe that human activity is the fundamental reason we are seeing climate change. You disagree with that?
I believe the ability to measure with precision the degree of human activity's impact on the climate is subject to more debate on whether the climate is changing or whether human activity contributes to it.
Eric Schaefer, your thoughts on that exchange?
Yeah, wow. Well, that's a lot of tap dancing. I'm glad he doesn't think it's global warming is just a pure hoax, or it's, you know, a Chinese hoax, as Mr. Trump has said. But this idea that we can't act until we know, which he said later in the testimony, precisely how much humans contribute to global warming, is really a dodge. The scientists say more than just we have a global warming problem. They say overwhelmingly it is caused by humans, and we have to act now until it's too late. That's the National Academy of Sciences. Scientists are pretty conservative. They have to pick their way through evidence and look at all the facts. It's hard to get a mammoth group of scientists to agree on a simple statement like global warming's a problem, it's accelerating, humans cause it, we need to act now before it's too late. And that's what you see over and over again from the scientific community.
Talking to Eric Schaefer from the Environmental Integrity Project, one of over 600 now former EPA officials who have signed on a letter asking the U.S. Senate not to confirm President Trump's nominee Scott Pruitt, Oklahoma Attorney General, to that post. You did some research at your group recently looking at the impact of regulation on jobs, and this is often an argument, environmental regulation versus jobs. One goes up, the other goes down. What did you find?
That claim is nonsense. EPA's made the whipping boy for job losses throughout the heartland. If you look at the actual data, it's automation, increases in productivity, mergers and acquisitions. One company swallows another. The Bureau of Labor Statistics data year after year shows that's what drives job loss. Those, you know, large economic and business decisions, not environmental regulation, which doesn't even score. I mean, it's less than 0.2% of the reason that we see shutdowns and mass layoffs in the Bureau of Labor Statistics data. And that's backed up by lots and lots of studies. And then finally, if you just look at trends over, you know, going back 40 or 50 years, we have fewer and fewer jobs in the manufacturing sector, as output increases. So in other words, what refineries produce goes up and up and up. The number of people working in those same refineries goes in the other direction as we automate. So that's the challenge. That it's important to keep people at work. It's important to have a strong and healthy manufacturing sector, but it's not simple. And the job decline is not because we have, you know, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act.
The Center for Media and Democracy filed a lawsuit in Oklahoma court today looking to force Pruitt to release records of communication with energy companies. It's over open records requests from the last couple of years. What do you make of that effort?
Well, that problem came up in Senate hearings. Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island pursued it. And there has been an open records request for communications with Americans for Prosperity between that group and Mr. Pruitt and his office, and communications involving other energy companies. The original request was made over 2 years ago. His office has acknowledged they have, just to that particular request, 3,000 emails and other communications with Americans for Prosperity and certain oil and gas companies. He hasn't coughed them up. It's been over 2 years. It felt to me like the Republican oversight committees on the Hill were obsessed with emails and getting all the emails from everyone in the Obama administration. And fair enough, you know, they had the right to ask for a lot of that. So where are they now? Why isn't he able to put those forward in response to an open records request that's more than 2 years old?
We'll leave it there for now, Eric. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Eric Schaefer, Executive Director of the Environmental Integrity Project and former Director of Civil Enforcement at the Environmental Protection Agency. He joined us to tell us why he and other former EPA officials have signed onto a statement against President Trump's pick for the head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear about the Citizens Water Lobby Day taking place at the Wisconsin State Capitol tomorrow. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up at 7 on Latino USA, in 2013, 9 young undocumented activists wearing their graduation caps and gowns walked from Mexico up to border officials in the U.S. and demanded to be granted asylum. They became a symbol of the so-called Dreamers who grew up undocumented in the United States. At a time of high tension over immigration, Latino USA revisits that story after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, as state lawmakers gather tomorrow at the state capitol to hear Governor Walker's budget address, they won't be alone. Grassroots groups and individuals from across Wisconsin are traveling to the capitol for another objective, what they're calling the Citizens Water Lobby Day.
The event's Facebook page encourages interested citizens to, quote, stand up, speak out, and demand sustainable and responsible water policy from our elected officials, end quote. From high-capacity wells to concerns over proposed large-scale agricultural operations and drinking water safety and beach quality alerts, there are a lot of issues on the table.
Christy Greening joins us now. She's on the board of the Sustain Rural Wisconsin Network, one of the groups behind tomorrow's Citizens Water Lobby Day event. Christy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how did this idea get off the ground for this Citizens Water Lobby Day?
Well, that's a very interesting story, actually. This all came about only about 3.5 weeks ago when a local grassroots organizer named Don Easted from the Concerned Rome Citizens Group in our neck of the woods in central Wisconsin approached me stating, I have a donor that is willing to pay for 6 charter buses from all over Wisconsin to get individuals to Madison to talk about water. What do you think? And I didn't really believe him at first, quite honestly. That's a pretty huge price tag and a pretty generous donation. And so the more I talked with Don, he approached me not only because I work with the same grassroots group that he does in the central Wisconsin area, but I also am a board member of the Sustain Rural Wisconsin Network. And I said, well, let's bring Mary Doherty into this call and see what we can go with it. So a week later, Mary Doherty and Don Easted and myself had our first conference call, and Citizen Water Lobby Day was planned. We started.
And so hundreds of people will be converging tomorrow at the Capitol. Why is now the right time to talk about water issues?
Well, if you look back, you know, Wisconsin really is at a tipping point. We're at a critical point right now. We have high-capacity well legislation that tried to get passed last session and, again, is already rumored to be brought up again, where we have lakes and streams running dry. We have folks that have lakefront property, but they don't have a lake anymore. You look over in the Kewaunee County area, which has the highest concentration of concentrated animal feeding operations, mm-hmm. and you have hundreds of folks that can't even drink the water out of their own faucet. And then you look at frac sand mining and other types of mining and shoreline zoning. There is water concerns with all these different groups, and citizens' voices continue to be ignored as many of our legislators just simply continue to take the money from the big lobby groups and put forth the legislation that they have written.
And you've said that these are everyday people who are traveling to Madison. These are not
Absolutely.
The polished people who do this as their jobs to lobby. These are newcomers to what lobbying is.
Absolutely. We have young folks getting on the bus. We have elderly folks. I just read in one of the Green Bay newspapers of a 75-year-old person getting on the bus for the first time to hit Madison. And this is what is bringing him to advocacy: water, water concerns, water issues. So we have a wide range, of everyday citizens coming down, not your typical polished lobbyist.
And in a recent op-ed that ran in the Cap Times, you wrote, "Water knows no boundaries and should be viewed as a nonpartisan issue in our legislature." In reality, though, do you actually see that happening?
Well, I can look through rose-colored glasses. you know, when I look at the makeup of our legislature right now, can I say it's going to happen this session? Maybe not, but we will never make any progress unless we start to try, unless we bring all of our groups together, you know, across the spectrum to stand shoulder to shoulder, to draw that line in the sand and say, we are not going to sit down, we are not going to shut up. You need to hear our concerns, and you need to hear concerns of all of Wisconsin's citizens, not just those in your district, because how can you really vote on legislation that is being promoted for the health and safety and welfare of Wisconsin citizens if you are just looking within your own boundaries in regards to water? Water knows no boundaries, and neither should our legislators.
But why do you think water issues have become so polarizing, so politicized?
Yeah, that's a very good question. When I look back at what's happening in our central Wisconsin area, we have large-scale vegetable growers that are pumping large amounts of water. And when I look at this last campaign session, hundreds of thousands of dollars went in to get that legislator elected. So where do I think his vote is going to go? It's not really going to go to the citizens that are coming down to Madison. It's going to go to that particular group that put so much money into his campaign coffer.
We're talking with Christy Greening. She's a board member and a spokesperson for the Sustain Rural Wisconsin Network. It's one of the groups behind tomorrow's Citizens Water Lobby Day event. Christy, now you come from a part of Wisconsin, Wisconsin Rapids, not far from the town of Saratoga, where
yep, that is where I live.
Oh, you come from, okay, Saratoga,
yep.
Yeah, where there's a proposed 5,300 cow dairy farm. It's been a hot topic of debate. Tell us about the situation there and your involvement in this.
Sure. The proposed Golden Sands Dairy is being looked at by the Waisaki organization to our township in Saratoga, which is definitely highly residential and recreational area. And we did form a grassroots group there called Protect Wood County and Its Neighbors. Right across the county line in Adams County is a Tri-Lakes area of the township of Rome. They have the Concerned Rome Citizens Group that is also, you know, opposing and fighting back against this CAFO. It's been 5 years. And we have tremendous citizen support in our area, just an unbelievable group of citizens in Rome and Saratoga that are willing to get up, stand up, you know, speak out every single time there is something moving forward with this proposal. And for 5 years, we've held them off, and they haven't cut a tree. And we're going to continue to hold them off and continue to fight.
Is there room, though, for CAFOs, you know, with these operations, these large operations, or do you see just no ability for a CAFO to be possible?
I don't think realistically anybody can sit back and say absolutely no CAFOs anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's not a realistic idea. However, where the Waisaki organization is trying to place this particular CAFO, Golden Sands Dairy, it's in a township that absolutely has no agriculture. It's a highly recreational residential area, and they want to come in and just plop it in the middle of the town where we reside on highly sandy soil. So when they use their high-capacity wells, and they spray irrigation of manure, and they're going to cut all the trees down, those nitrates and phosphates and chemicals, they're going to leach into our groundwater rapidly.
Talk a little about high-capacity wells. They become very controversial in mm-hmm. Wisconsin in recent years. So far, these wells have remained fairly regulated, but State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said he wants to pass a bill that would let owners of existing high-capacity wells repair or replace them without a permit. So what about this issue of high-capacity wells and what you'd like to see going forward?
Sure. In regards to the high-capacity well situation, it really depends on what side you look at. I don't think anybody is against the family farmer passing down his farm to his son and wanting to transfer the rights of that high-capacity well to keep the farm and the family and whatnot. It's a situation where these large corporate agriculture entities are coming in and buying smaller farms or buying properties with the high-capacity wells where originally they didn't have a high level of pumping, and now it's going to be an excessive amount of pumping. And if the DNR doesn't have the ability to go in and say, okay, hold on a minute, we went from pumping X amount to quadrupling that amount, there needs to be some type of policing power in there to ensure that you don't just automatically get these wells and pump as much water as you want for as long as you want. And so there is those pieces of the legislation that people are really fighting. But those are also the pieces of the legislation that some of the legislators are trying to keep hidden.
We're talking right now with Christy Greening about water issues in Wisconsin and tomorrow's Citizens Lobby Day on these issues at the state capitol. And you can join in our discussion at 800-642-1234.
Is there an important water issue, something you're worried about in your community? Is there a development that's coming along that has you worried about the quality of the water? Do you have lead in your part of the state in your water? Runoff, other issues, beach quality alerts. Do you think Wisconsin's doing enough to protect water quality and quantity? What kind of solutions are you hoping for? Or are you involved with a business, an operation that uses a lot of water? Do you think you're getting an unfair rap sometimes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with Christy Greening. She sits on the board of the Sustain Rural Wisconsin Network. It's one of the groups behind tomorrow's Citizens Water Lobby Day event, which aims to bring citizens' voices to the state capitol on issues related to water quality around the state.
You can join in as well at 800-642-1234. Do you think enough is being done in Wisconsin to protect our water? What are the water issues that you're worried about? And what do you see as possible solutions? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Christy, you're going to have many people coming from many parts of the state with such varied things that are top of mind for them that are focused on water in their life.
Absolutely.
So lawmakers will be hearing a lot of different issues. What do you want the takeaway to be?
The main takeaway for our legislators is a couple different things. One, to realize that when looking at water legislation, they need to look at all the different issues that are happening in Wisconsin and not just be focusing on one small issue for one small area. We are encouraging people to bring their water stories, and we actually encourage folks to write your story and leave it behind in the legislators' offices. How can you make good policy for Wisconsin if you don't know what's happening around Wisconsin? And so we're encouraging our attendees to hit all legislative offices, not just their representatives.
Well, let's go to the phones now with Luke from Van Dyne. Hi, Luke.
Hi.
What would you like to add about water?
Okay, in answer to Rob's question, yes, I have one of those issues, both issues, the CAFO, an operation that has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years. It's a huge building with hundreds and hundreds of cows, causing a very nasty odor, by the way, not to mention I'm sure it's got to be doing damage to the water. And the other thing is, you know, my neighbor, and I don't know, I don't want to point any fingers, but neighbors, whatever, as far as, see, I have an old farmhouse, and the original well is, I use it once in a while, and it just, like, out of the blue goes dry.
Hmm.
And I used to think it was just, oh, we haven't had a lot of rain, so it's, you know, pretty shallow well, it's old, it goes dry. Well, it went dry when there was plenty of rain happening, and it's happened so many times that I'm, you know, now there's the answer. There must be a high-capacity well doing that in my area.
Christy, have you heard those types of anecdotes?
Oh, absolutely. We have worked a lot with the folks out around the Central Sands Dairy in the Juneau County town of Armenia, where there's water testing wells out there that are ranging as high as 75 parts per million in nitrate. And, you know, most people understand that 10 is the absolute limit where folks should not be drinking or bathing. And there's folks out in that area that the only thing their water is good for is flushing the toilet. When they brush their teeth, they have to distill the water. When they wash their hands, they have to use some type of Germex or other cloth. They literally can't use the water in their own homes.
Hmm. Let's take another call now. Thank you, Luke, for your thoughts. Let's go to Gary in Waukesha. Hi, Gary.
Hi there.
What would you like to add?
Well, I'd like to make several comments. One is, where is the DNR regulation? Where is the federal regulation for a maximum number of head of cattle per acre to avoid contaminating everyone's private wells? Why does this even allow to happen that all those people have to go and buy bottled water and they don't have any recourse to sue these CAFOs to get a lifetime supply of potable water?
What about the DNR, Christy?
You know, over the past 5 years that I have been working, you know, fighting the CAFO to our area, we have definitely seen the power and the enforcement power of the DNR being stripped. You know, budget after budget, year after year, more and more authority has been taken away from the DNR. And it's sad. Some of the best folks we have worked with at the DNR have chosen to leave. You know, ethically, they have chosen to leave because of what is happening with that department. And it's even more scary as we hear that now they're looking at breaking the DNR apart and, you know, moving it from one department to another. It's just another step in really the destruction of Wisconsin.
Let's hear now from Irene in Burlington. Hi, Irene.
Hi, and I'm sorry I can't turn off my radio because I'm in the car, so you know it might be problematic.
You're okay.
Okay. So what my issue is getting the public to understand that it's in everybody's vested interest to protect groundwater. We have as an issue out here the protection of groundwater. I live in a rural area. I've done a lot of research dealing with the U.S. Geological Survey, who has an office at UWM, and know that the the drawdown of groundwater in southeastern Wisconsin is the greatest in the state. It's much worse than it is in Plover. In fact, our water is being sucked into Illinois by the high-capacity wells that are located in the western Chicago suburbs. And yet you can't get people to react because, or to understand the issue, because the first thing they say is my well going to go dry? Well, right now, no, but eventually, maybe, and, you know, long-term, certainly, yes. And people that are in Lake Michigan, they don't care because they have lake water. And, oh, by the way, I just don't want any sewage going down the Root River, without understanding that this is an issue for the whole state. Well, groundwater does not understand boundaries. It recognizes no boundaries.
This is a very personal issue, water being a very personal issue. And as you mentioned, tomorrow people are coming with these personal issues and,
yes,
and addressing them to lawmakers. And Irene addressed groundwater and wells and groundwater going dry and drying up these water from these natural sources. What issues do you see there?
You definitely, when I reflect again back in my central Wisconsin area, because that is my background, we have numerous lakes and streams that have gone dry. We have pictures on our internet page where you can see docks stretching out into a grassland. Lakes that once were home to fish and fishermen, and you could ski and swim without concern, they're no longer there. So to say that high-capacity wells aren't adding to that problem is ridiculous. Speaking with legislators here just a week ago, an individual made the comment, if indeed lakes are drying up, we may have to do a study. Well, in the Central Sands area, we have 60 years of study. We have, you know, hydrologists and scientists that have documented the Central Sands. We know what is causing the problem. It's time to act.
Well, before we go here, as we close, Karen in Cottage Grove has called in wanting to know if anyone can drop in on tomorrow's event. So can you go into the particulars of what will happen tomorrow?
Sure, absolutely. This event is open to absolutely anybody. You don't have to have a CAFO concern. You don't have to have a frac sand concern. This event is open to anybody that has a concern with their water. The event check-in is in room 425 southwest of the Capitol. In that room, you can just filter on through. You will get your event badge, a pin, you'll get all the necessary handouts and information, the agenda for the day, and then you're off and running. Everybody is welcome.
And this is happening just hours before the budget address, and so wondering what, in terms of clean water initiatives, what would you like to hear out of the budget proposal very quickly here? We're running short.
What I would like to hear is that they are actually going to take a look at water concerns and bring everybody to the table.
Christy, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. Christy Greening is a board member and spokesperson for the Sustain Rural Wisconsin Network. It's one of the groups behind tomorrow's Citizens Water Lobby Day event. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.